This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, there's a real estate boom in Texas. Rules have changed and developers are cleaning up contaminated industrial sites to build new city projects. We go to Dallas. Philosopher Henry David Thoreau and rock band drummer Don Henley have something in common. They were both attached to Walden Pond and the woods around it. Tips on building a green stock portfolio. Our ear to the ground goes to the prettiest painted places in America, where paint has changed the environment in whole neighborhoods. And in the Earth calendar, we go to a turkey farm where they're getting ready for Thanksgiving. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. This is the Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For the last 20 years, a 22-acre site next to downtown Dallas, Texas, sat vacant and abandoned. Before, it used to be a paint factory, which contaminated the land with toxic chemicals and heavy metals. Today, the site is being cleaned up, and a $34 million private housing project, known as Jefferson at North End, is under construction. Abandoned industrial sites are known as brownfields. For years, developers would not touch brownfield sites because they were afraid of being held liable for future cleanup. But today in Texas, brownfield development is a hot area for real estate entrepreneurs. Greg Cook is an environmental lawyer and a partner in the Austin law firm of Hayes & Boone. He describes the changes that have brought private capital into brownfield site development.
The first key change, at least in the Texas program, when the state environmental agency plus the EPA agreed that once you cleaned up a piece of property, at the end of the process, you got a certificate that operated as a release of liability for the new owner. So the new owner could then buy the property without any fear of environmental liability. And to give that release for both state and federal law gave a comfort level to financial institutions, investors, and insurance companies that had never existed before, and therefore has unleashed a capital market to clean up these properties that just wasn't available before.
Ron Kirk, mayor of Dallas, is proud of the fact that his city was one of a small group selected by EPA to pilot brownfield initiatives. He says the Texas program has been enthusiastically received by the private sector.
One of our real challenges is how do we continue to meet the growth needs of our community and do that without duplicating infrastructure and moving further and further from the inner city. And many developers love this because there are, in every community, there are a number of environmentally challenged sites, as I guess I would call them, that could be great for construction of commercial or retail or entertainment facilities, but the unlimited exposure and potential cost of the environmental remediation just makes the development of those sites unproductive. So developers are very strong supporters of this program, and it's a plus for those of us mayors that are seeking to revive our inner cities. It's great for the development because it levels the playing field in terms of their cost. And I think for those of us that are concerned about the environment, they see it as a plus because we're removing some of these depleted, ugly eyesores and environmentally contaminated sites from our landscape.
A key to getting private developers to clean up contaminated sites has been to adjust cleanup requirements to the eventual use of the land. This means land which might become a playground for a kindergarten would have to be cleaned up to a higher standard than an area to be paved over for a parking lot. Getting agreement on a cleanup plan requires a lot of work. And according to Mayor Kirk, it can only happen if the local community is involved at the beginning of the process.
We worked very hard on the front end to involve community groups, environmental groups, and the type of the program and drafting the guidelines for what sites would be eligible. And we had a site that we cleaned up in West Dallas, which is one of our poorest parts of our community. It's dominated by predominantly African American and Hispanic families, and we were able to clean up an old, the old typical battery lead contaminated soil and go in with a new business that put 22 people to work. Well, in part of our community that has been absent in a new real job growth of production for years, having 22, you know, to potentially now 20, you know, 30 to 35 good paying jobs in the heart of the community was a very welcome addition, on top of the fact that it took away a real eyesore and a sensitive issue with respect to those families worrying about their children playing on these contaminated sites.
The developer of the 22-acre North Jefferson project in Dallas is a Broomfield joint venture. Keith Cope is the manager. He says brownfield development is still not easy. No financing is available until after cleanup is completed. So in the Dallas project, the joint venture had to put up $2 million to pay for cleanup before it could secure financing to go ahead. Still, brownfields present opportunities, and a brownfield site, once given a clean bill of health, may be less risky than an ordinary tract.
Now, you can go out and buy a piece of farmland thinking you're buying a clean piece of real estate because there's never been any development on it, but you may in fact be exposed to, you know, some contamination from fertilizers or what have you, and be exposed to enforcement actions where, in this instance, you're not.
That was Keith Cope, joint venture manager for the Broomfield Joint Venture in Dallas. There are thousands of brownfields across the country. Most are in urban or industrial areas, which are served by existing transportation and utility infrastructure. Redeveloping them will save greenfields, which might be developed instead. The program in Dallas is showing that private sector redevelopment of contaminated sites can be good for communities, for cities, for developers, and for the environment as well. Don Henley is probably most recognized as former rock and roll singer and drummer of the Eagles. However, Henley is very active in the environmental community, focusing his attention on a number of concerns from wetlands in Texas to old-growth forests in California. Just recently, President Clinton awarded Henley the National Humanities Medal for his efforts to save Walden Woods from development. Now, he's reflecting on the battle over the property made famous by Henry David Thoreau. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports.
In Walden, Thoreau wrote, "But since I left those shores, the woodchoppers have still further laid down them waste. And now, for many a year, there will be no more rambling through the aisles of the wood, with occasional vistas through which you see the water. My muse may be excused if she is silent henceforth. How can you expect the birds to sing when their groves are cut down?" Even then, Henry David Thoreau understood why loggers and developers were attracted to the wooded area near Concord, Massachusetts. So it wouldn't have surprised Thoreau that in 1990, businessmen were hoping to develop the area. Don Henley was among the many environmentalists appalled by the idea of Walden Woods, the birthplace of the American environmental movement, being developed. He says he first heard of the proposals while watching television.
I was watching the cable news network one day, and I saw some people talking about the impending destruction of Walden Woods, or portions of it. They were talking about some proposed developments there. One was an office park. I love that term, office park. It's such an oxymoron. And the other development was a condominium complex. And both these developments were pretty near Walden Pond. And having been influenced a lot by Emerson and Thoreau in my 20s when I was struggling to become a songwriter, both these men and the things they said and the things they wrote have been very important to me throughout my lifetime.
After discussing his concerns with a number of people in the spring of 1990, Henley started the Walden Woods Project. He received the support of such big names as Whoopi Goldberg, Ted Danson, Bette Midler, and Ted Kennedy, influential people he would likely need in order to win this fight.
Well, one of the developers is named Mort Zuckerman, and he is a well-known mogul, I guess you would call him. He's the owner and publisher of the New York Daily News, as well as the Atlantic Magazine and U.S. News and World Report magazine. He is also a developer of some note. He was the guy who was going to build the office park. And he's not a bad guy, I suppose. He just wasn't aware or wasn't really concerned with the significance of the property that he owned. His main argument being that it was separated from Walden Woods proper by a highway, which doesn't really make any difference to us. You know, it's still part of the historical Walden Woods.
With the help of a group called the Trust for Public Land, the Walden Woods Project saved the woods from the original proposed developments as well as acquiring adjoining parcels of land. In 7 years, the project has raised $17 million, saving approximately 100 acres. Today, the larger part of the 2,600 acres of Walden Woods proper is protected, but Henley says there are still parcels his group would like to buy. In the meantime, the project is working on the Thoreau Institute, scheduled to open next spring or summer, which includes a number of programs.
We have been generously given the two largest Thoreau collections in the world, and they will be kept in this climate-controlled archive. Portions of these collections can be taken out and studied by serious Thoreau scholars. We are also building a reading library, a microfilm library, digital equipment, and Lucent Technologies have donated about $1 million worth of computer technology to the Institute, which is being installed now. We have appointed a teacher's advisory committee, and we will be creating curricula, which will be sent out to schools all over the world via the Internet.
Besides Walden Woods, Henley says he is concerned with the fate of the Headwaters Forest in California. Henley says federal efforts to save 7,500 acres there does not go far enough. He doesn't believe environmental issues are receiving enough attention.
In fact, I think the current Congress that we have, especially the House of Representatives, is shameful. Most of them are in the pockets of big business, you know, in the corporations that run the world. And, you know, they love to tell people that there's really not a problem, that, you know, that you can throw enough technology and money at these problems and they will go away. And the scientific community thinks otherwise.
But before we change the system, Henley believes we need to change ourselves first in order to make significant preservation and conservation reforms. Everybody can do something, he says. It begins locally and just takes thoughtfulness. I'm Stephen Westcott for The Environment Show.
This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Green tips are coming up next. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E.
I'm Rachel Phillips, and this is Green Tips, tips on how you can help to save the world in your everyday life. Financial advisors usually tell us to save more money so they can tell us how to invest it. Ordinary Americans are investing in the stock market in record numbers. Most of us don't think of a trip to Wall Street as an affirmation of environmental activism, but the fact is that by investing in environmentally sound companies and by staying away from the polluters, you may be able to help the environment and incubate your nest egg at the same time. One way to do this is to pick a mutual fund that screens the companies it invests in using criteria like a company's environmental compliance record or its sustainable use of raw materials. There are quite a number of environmentally responsible funds, and 11 of them produced a return of 20% or more during 1996. So if you pick the right one, you can invest green and increase your greenbacks at the same time. One way to get started is to call the nonprofit organization Co-op America. It can send you a list of environmentally responsible mutual funds with records of their performance. Its number is 1-800-58-GREEN. That's 1-800-58-GREEN. Even if the market crashes, at least you'll have a green portfolio. With Green Tips, I'm Rachel Phillips.
What do you think philosopher Thoreau would have to say about exercising your environmental conscience by playing the stock market? Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. While old paint factories left environmental disaster, like the site in Dallas, modern paints are adding zip to some neighborhoods.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, painting the town red, blue, or green. A look at the prettiest painted places in America. For those with a penchant for paint, beauty can translate to colorful Victorian mansions replete with gingerbread and other ornamentation, or perhaps the hot pinks and turquoises of adobe homes near the Mexican border. Whatever your taste, the first ever Prettiest Places in America contest is bound to have something for everyone. The competition was devised by the Paint Quality Institute in conjunction with Better Homes and Gardens and architecture magazines. Obviously, promoting paint is at the heart of the contest, but the results, explains John Stouffer, director of the Institute, are transformations that boost the spirit of places.
It's just fantastic, some of the places where, you know, how the impact has been in civic pride and just getting people to really feel good about their places. There were some very, very nice stories. Homeowners were so pleased with what they were seeing in their neighborhoods that they, you know, were turning around and redoing their homes. And just sort of spread from one household to another, for example. So that was very, very gratifying.
To identify the nicest appearing places across the country, 11,000 Chamber of Commerces were invited to nominate residential or commercial buildings in their small town or large city. Photos were submitted along with information about the history of the place, the architecture, and the context of these buildings to their surroundings. Stouffer says after on-site inspections, 60 finalists were whittled down to 12 winners, two from six different geographic regions. Among the winners was the coastal town of Cape May, New Jersey, with its lavish Victorian homes. Wyoming, Ohio, described as having the look of a Norman Rockwell painting. There's the Art Deco Historic District of Miami Beach, with its pastel palette that mimics the sea. Deadwood, South Dakota, a section of St. Louis, and Tubac, Arizona, with its stucco and adobe buildings. Stouffer says while most winners focused on attractively painted structures, one town, Toppenish, Washington, was quite different.
Toppenish was quite unique. The environment there in town has been completely transformed by the use of paint in the form of high-quality murals. And there are 46 of them there presently, and more planned, and they are done by professional artists, and they depict some aspect of the history of Toppenish, whether it be clearing the land by settlers, or some activities in the rodeo, or some notable person from Toppenish. And it's really completely transformed the outlook of the folks that live there. It's become a real stop for travelers and tourists, and students are really picking up a grand appreciation for the history of the place through the murals.
Paint, Stouffer says, is used primarily for protecting the painted surface from the elements. but enhancing the functional aspect of paint with aesthetic considerations creates communities where people sit up and take notice. And that, Stouffer says, doesn't mean buildings have to be wildly colorful, just having a nice appearance like the traditional white and green houses of New England will do. When preparing to paint, he advises the use of high-quality paint. The Institute doesn't endorse any particular brands. And good brushes. Always be sure to have adequate ventilation. And Stouffer adds, use good cleanup habits.
Excess paint should be discarded properly. Certainly, one thing to keep in mind is that a good way to utilize paint, of course, is to use it up rather than just, you know, using a partial container and then trying to dispose of it. In other words, keep the paint and look for ways to utilize it and use it in that fashion. Then I think it's very, very important to not, for example, pour paint down the drain. Paint should be disposed of either in a recycling center, if it's still wet paint, and check with the local authorities in terms of waste management before disposing of any liquid paint.
Whether it's earth tones or bright splashes of color, John Stouffer says the prettiest painted places in America are made from the hard efforts of individuals. They are places that lift up your spirits, and not just because they look great, but because they inspire. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar, and we continue our series on the Great American Harvest. For turkey growers, this is the critical time as birds are prepared for Thanksgiving. We talked to Lynn Bennett of Bennett Turkey Farms in Wilbraham, Massachusetts. It's a family business, and they've been producing birds since 1925. Four generations of Bennetts are involved. We go to New England to talk turkey at Thanksgiving because, after all, schoolchildren are taught that the first Thanksgiving took place there.
Well, New England is the most wonderful area to raise a turkey. As the leaves start to turn color, our turkeys eat a lot more, and they put on weight, and you get a nice, plump, juicy turkey. It takes good, fresh water, clean air, and a nice, large area for them to walk around in. We do have free-range turkeys. We have done that since 1925, when it wasn't as popular.
Lynn says a lot happens before you can pick up that six-month-old turkey, which is ready to stuff and put in the oven. First, the turkey hens are artificially inseminated to produce a fertility rate of about 90%. Each hen lays about 60 eggs, and a total of 10 to 15,000 birds are produced on the farm each year.
If you're raising 10 to 15,000, you're producing a lot of eggs.
We sure are. A lot of omelets. We hatch our own eggs right here on the farm. We have a large building that just has an incubator in it and rotates the eggs, and we keep our own hatcher and raise our own little baby chicks.
Birds are fed soybean meal and corn from local suppliers. Lynn Bennett says it's healthy stuff, which we ourselves could eat. As a result, the turkeys grow.
I'll tell you, we have had some turkeys that weighed over 40 pounds. And believe it or not, there is a large demand. We have a few customers that want them at 50 pounds. And we don't have too many that size, but we have a range of 10 pounds all the way up to 40 and over.
And then do you butcher them on the farm?
Yes, we do. We have our own processing plant right here on the farm, so we're very self-sufficient.
And who plucks them?
Well, we actually have a machine that does that.
No more plucking by hand.
No, we'd be here till New Year's.
I was going to say, we raise a few turkeys for ourselves to eat on our farm, but plucking them is mighty hard work.
Yes, it is.
Do you find that as people get more concerned about organic food and so on, that people different things when they buy turkeys now than when they used to?
Oh, yes. And that's why our farm has become, our turkeys are in such a demand. We just can't produce enough turkeys to make everybody happy. As you can hear, our phones are ringing off the hook. Because, you know, we do have a free range, our turkeys aren't organic. But we've never used anything, any additives or anything, you know. And plus, we deal with a fresh turkey. It's almost an impossible thing to get today, you know. Ours are fresh. They've never been in that freezer. When that person picks the turkey up at the store, it's fresh.
It sounds pretty special.
Now, well, I like to use the analogy. It's kind of like having a native tomato, you know? Nice and fresh and juicy, and that's our turkeys.
So enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner and give thanks for a bounteous land, where it's better to be a Thanksgiver than it is to be a turkey. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burling. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burling. An environment mall? Instead of going to see the real thing, you could see redwoods in the desert at a mall. Does this further environmental education or just prove that the mauling of ecosystems has no limits? We talk green about one of the most fractious issues on the environmental horizon, immigration. Are there environmental reasons to limit immigration? How do these arguments fit in a country of immigrants which claims to offer freedom and opportunity to those who come to our shores? If there's a wedding in your family, believe it or not, there's a book out organizing a green wedding. Unless, of course, you take the bus to City Hall and have the clerk do it, which is greener still. We're all familiar with nature centers, but now there's a new twist on an old idea. The Nature Mall. Malls are packaging everything for us these days, and now they're marketing nature. Ogden Entertainment recently opened its first of 8 nature-based theme parks, slated to be constructed in various parts of the United States. The mall-type attractions provide customers with a look at various animal species and ecosystems, combined with high-tech rides, interactive games, dining facilities, and even a cocktail lounge. Company officials say the park educates the public and promotes conservation and preservation. But commercial elements of the parks raise the issue of whether such facilities actually educate the public about the natural world or provide entertainment only. The Environment Show's Rachel Phillips looks at the company's first park and how one environmental organization views its educational value.
The American Wilderness Experience, or AWE, as it is called, is located in Ontario Mills, California, and San Bernardino County, about 45 miles east of Los Angeles. Ogden Enterprises promotes AWE as the first in-mall nature-based attraction, the only attraction of its kind in America. Bill Ziegler, Vice President of Conservation and Science for AWE, says that this particular park provides customers with a look at California's 5 biomes, or ecoregions.
We have a desert biome, a redwood forest biome, coastal habitat, high mountaintop or high Sierra habitat, as well as we decided, because it is such a nationally known environment, the Yosemite Valley is one of them as well.
The facility is 30,000 square feet in size, which is relatively small compared to other nature facilities. But Ziegler says the facility exceeds all state, federal, and professional guidelines for minimum housing requirements for animals. He says the company has made each display as real as possible for the 70 species, as well as patrons.
And so when a person walks into each biome, which is a large room, like in the redwood forest, you actually walk into a redwood forest. We have recreated redwood trees, sequoia trees, the mist, the sound, the scent even, of the redwood environment.
Ziegler says the focus of the park is habitat preservation and backyard conservation. He He believes the mall is just one way of getting this message to the public.
We provide a more or a closer intimate relationship that we think combined with film, combined with print media, combined with school programs, has made an impact. And when you take a look at things like the California condor, the black-footed ferret, the American bison, Swift fox, and a list of animals that goes on, that the benefit that we have provided through education, through captive breeding programs combined, well justifies, I believe, what we're doing.
Company officials hope awe will inspire people to experience the natural world for themselves and better to understand the plight of certain species in California. But can high-tech rides, cocktail lounges, and other mall-like commercial features detract from the educational process, presenting an almost antiseptic or sanitized natural world? Is that natural at all? How educational are such parks? Roy Geiger, National Wildlife Federation's Coordinator for Education and Volunteer Programs at the headquarters in Vienna, Virginia, says a nature center or even a nature mall doesn't necessarily have to show a bobcat eating a marmot to illustrate the importance of predator-prey relationships. Nature centers or malls like AWE can be educational if they fulfill three objectives, according to Geiger.
First off, is the concept of awareness, just making people aware of bears or cacti or ecosystems and things like that. Secondly, there's an appreciation where you help the person or the person becomes aware enough of the topic that they start to become not just aware of it, but they have an appreciation. They respect the fact that a bear is a bear, or this is what makes a cacti different from other plants, or that you have a desert zone versus a mountain zone, and that kind of thing. And finally, the third step is when the person gets involved with that particular topic.
Geiger says the third objective requires people to put education into action. He believes AWE probably fulfills at least the first objective. He also hopes that tour guides at AWE are able to direct customers to local centers or conservation groups where people can make a difference. Geiger says National Wildlife Federation sees value in AWE's facility as long as people get outside and experience the real thing as a result. But it isn't always easy since most of us are now living in urban areas.
I think Americans and those of us of the quote-unquote civilized industrial world have become totally detached, or in some cases anywhere from somewhat to totally detached from our connection with natural resources. And not saying we all need to go back to a simpler, gentler time, because that's not a realistic picture at all, but water, for most people, water is nothing more than a resource that comes from a tap and goes down a drain, and they have no clue where the water comes from, other than the tap or the spigot, and once it goes down the drain, they have basically no clue where it goes.
Geiger believes there's a real danger as people become more and more detached from natural systems and cycles. He says it's important for people to use whatever means they can to contact the natural world, even if the American wilderness experience is the only source available to them. For the Environment Show, I'm Rachel Phillips.
We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about a subject which evokes a lot of emotion, and that's immigration policy and the environment. Specifically, should the U.S. limit or stop immigration in order to protect our environment and quality of life? We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Give us a call. I have two guests with me who have widely differing views. One is Daniel Stein. He's Executive Director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform, or FAIR. That's an immigration reform group, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. Also with me is Santos Gomez, and he's a member of the Organizing Board of Political Ecology Group, or PEG, based in San Francisco. and PEG is an immigration rights organization. So, Dan Stein from FAIR, let's start with you. A lot of American environmentalists either came here from other lands or are descendants of people who did. So why should they seek to limit immigration today?
Well, I think the question has to be answered in terms of what other countries around the world are doing to stabilize their population growth rates and what our country's obligations are to our future generations in stabilizing our own growth rates. In the mid-1970s, the United States was fortunate enough to see its own fertility rates drop to the point where population stabilization seemed very likely as a long-term prospect. And population rates and the size of the population are strong determinants of future environmental quality, and as well as the ease with which environmental goals can be met in changing consumption patterns and behavior patterns down the line. Without a lot of real public debate or discussion, the United States has developed an immigration policy which is destined to fuel U.S. population growth rates that are really the highest in the industrialized world. And at a time when perhaps 50% of all our wetlands have already been lost in our country, and wetland loss is perhaps at the highest of any industrialized country, and when a whole range of domestic environmental goals are really being challenged for political reasons, much of it associated with population growth-related pressures, we need to ask ourselves, why are we admitting immigrants today at the levels we are? Are immigration policies that may have been appropriate at the time of either the dawn of the Industrial Revolution or earlier, at a time when we had essentially a wilderness continent, are those policies appropriate for today and tomorrow?
Okay, well, let's hear from you, Santos Gomez. I would assume you take a somewhat different view of limiting immigration for the sake of the environment.
We do. Anti-immigrant groups and some population activists are manipulating people's valid environmental fears and misdirecting blame on immigrants for increasing U.S. population pressures. Research shows that immigrants are not the cause of environmental problems. Blaming immigrants makes environmental problems worse by ignoring the root causes and by ignoring the root solutions.
And so, from your perspective, should we leave our immigration policies alone? Should they be modified in some way, or should we simply focus our environmental energies in other places?
Well, from an environmental perspective, as an environmental organization that we are, we're just not an immigrant organization, we feel that the number of people, to focus exclusively on the number of people or the number of immigrants, is a misleading way to look at environmental impact. It's more important to focus, for example, on how we live, where we live, the level of consumption, the things we're consuming, the mismanagement of environmental resources, and focus on addressing those issues as a means of protecting the environment. Let me give you just an example. The people who controlled most of the resources have most of the environmental impact. Worldwide, the top 20% of the consumers consume more than 60% of the world's resources. By comparison, the bottom 20% of the world's population consumes less than 2% of the world's resources. To simply focus on the numbers doesn't help us to understand how to fix destructive environmental activities.
Dan Stein, I think one of the things I hear Santos saying is that this overall consumption issue is one which transcends our borders, and therefore one needs to look at it more globally.
Well,
is that something that you folks wrestle with?
Well, Peter, I think we're looking at essentially two different philosophies here. FAIR doesn't dispute the need to look at consumption or to look at the global impact of certain consumption practices or the disproportionate consumption patterns in some countries over others. But our contention here is that immigration is entitled to respect as a policy issue in the same way that any other environmental issue is in this country and around the world. We are. My primary obligation is to my children, my grandchildren, and the country that we leave behind, and that there is no inconsistency in trying to improve American environmental husbandry practices, or improving our consumption patterns to be more hospitable as a global partner, and still recognizing that the nation state does matter in the modern world, and that each country. Sovereignty entails responsibility, and that just as Mexico has certain obligations to its future generations and its obligations to the rest of the world, we do too. And that we can't solve the population problem of the rest of the world by letting everyone simply come here. We can't ignore immigration as a vital component in the mix, determining whether this country achieves sustainable environmental practices. And what I think the difference between our points of view here is that we don't see immigration as the sole determining factor by any means, or that we're focusing on immigration to the exclusion of anything else is what is appropriate. The debate going on right now is whether immigration policy should be formulated with some view toward its impact on environmental and sustainability goals down the line.
How do you deal with the criticism that is often leveled that really what's happening here is middle and upper income majority environmentalists who are seeking to limit immigration are simply trying to close the door to folk who are less fortunate or come from different racial backgrounds? And what really is happening here is this is just kind of an encircling the wagons and closing the doors. How do you cope with that criticism, which has often been leveled?
I cope with it, I guess, by trying to move forward with a discussion of what are the proper immigration policies that will leave, you know, my grandchildren a country worth living in. And if you consider the fact that immigration is now accounting for some 60% of U.S. population growth, that immigrants, when they come here, it's true that immigrants don't come here driving big cars that guzzle gas. But the reality is that immigrants come here aspiring to live the high consumption American dream.
Santos, how do you react to that, the notion that nothing is solved by basically keeping the borders relatively open?
Well, I kind of disagree. I think that things are solved. And let me just give you an example. I don't think that immigration is an environmental issue. I don't think by closing our borders, we're going to solve our industrial waste that's being dumped into rivers. I don't think we're going to make our air better, air that's making people sick. I don't think we're going to save wetlands. None of these issues, none of these problems are caused by immigrants. In fact, I believe that blaming immigrants lets big polluters off the hook. It allows our overconsumption to continue, our mismanagement of natural resources to continue. It allows us to not focus on our lacks of environmental enforcement. So to focus on closing the border, I think, and blaming immigrants diverts our attention from the solutions. More importantly, I believe that you really have to question the science and motives of the people pushing anti-immigrant policies as a way of protecting the environment. I think there are many, many other priorities that we should focus on and many root causes that we should be working to address before focusing on a divisive issue that will undermine the effectiveness of not just the Sierra Club, which is the current organization that is considering this anti-immigrant initiative, but the whole environmental movement, not just domestically, but internationally as well.
Dan Stein, how do you respond to the notion that environmental priorities, if we really want to clean things up, would be better directed in other areas and other directions, which I think is what Santos is saying.
I think his argument seems to be because stopping immigration tomorrow will not immediately solve the issue of toxic waste, that therefore we shouldn't think about our immigration policy, okay? I never said, we never say, FAIR doesn't say, and I don't think anyone else says that stopping immigration is going to solve all of our environmental problems. But it is an ostrich-like position for this one particular issue, immigration and its huge impact on U.S. population growth, to act as though somehow the fact that, you know, almost doubling your population within your lifetime isn't going to have profound ecological and environmental impacts.
Well, let's be more specific. We have, I don't know what the current number is, but we've got folks coming into the United States, both legally and illegally. How would you affect those numbers if you could? Would you limit them to a fraction of where they are now? What is a number that you would be comfortable with?
We don't believe that immigration should be a major factor in fueling population growth in this country at all. To the extent that immigration could have been limited 20 years ago at a sustainability level, we could have capped it at about 200,000 to 300,000. Right now, because of the impact that immigrants have had on U.S. fertility rates, you know, literally, the most important, something like 90% of U.S. population growth today is as a result of post-1970 immigrants and their descendants.
Yes,
90%.
But the question is, in light of the current level, where would you settle?
At the lowest possible level. The lowest possible level. We would like to see immigration, you know, maintained at levels below 200,000.
And Santos Gomez, how about you? Is that a number which sounds inappropriate from your perspective?
I don't think that, as I said, to argue for environmental restrictions on the grounds of protecting the environment is really to mislead the public environmentalist. And it's simply a divisive issue, a wedge issue, like other issues such as affirmative action, English only. I think if we're truly concerned about protecting the environment, that should be our focus.
We've been talking green on the Environment Show. My guests have been Daniel Stein. He's executive director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and Santos Gomez, who is from the Political Ecology Group. Mr. Stein's organization would like to limit immigration, and we've heard Mr. Gomez say that if we're concerned about the environment, we should place our energies in other places. We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I'm your host, Peter Burley.
You can hear us anytime on your personal computer and also tell us what you think on our webpage. You can reach us at www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. When the average person hears of a green wedding, they might think of a wedding party as draped in hunter green or some other shade, but that's not quite what we mean when we say the wedding is green. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports on a new book that might provide helpful hints for the special day when the environmentalist in the family ties the hemp knot.
A green wedding? Just the thought might create images of the bride and groom being married by Smokey Bear, with Ranger Rick serving as usher and guests throwing granola as the happy couple exits a log cabin. But that's not quite how Carol Reed Jones defines a green wedding. She is author of the book Green Weddings That Don't Cost the Earth. She and her husband were planning their special day in 1993 when they decided they wanted a wedding that reflects their values.
And so as I began collecting different information on green vendors and so on, I just realized that this would be a time to start making it into a book.
Invitations, party favors, and wedding dresses are all items that are usually thrown away after the big day or simply never used again. Carol Reed Jones decided to cut down on the amount of waste and expense at her wedding. She settled on an outdoor ceremony where guests with green thumbs helped to make bouquets with $60 worth of flowers bought at the local grocery store. She says it's this type of waste not, want not philosophy that makes a green wedding truly green.
Part of it is to look at what you're doing and ask yourself, do we really need this, or is this just something that's expected of us? Do we need limousines for everyone in the wedding party? Do we need a limousine ourselves? Do we need to give disposable cameras to the guests to take people's pictures and that sort of thing? It's possible to cut down on a lot of that kind of stuff and save money.
With many of today's couples spending thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars for their weddings, Reed Jones says the aim is to cut down on excess as well. She says a good place to start is the invitations, and it means going beyond using recycled paper.
In lieu of a regular printed invitation, if you're comfortable with this, it is possible to invite people by phoning them. And there's a company called Earth Tones that's an environmentally friendly long-distance company, and they donate their profits to environmental causes. You could even use them. Another thing is you can invite them, and Emily Post says this is very flattering, you can invite them by writing them a letter. The other things are, when you're picking invitations, you don't need to have some of those extra envelopes and things in the middle. And if you do go with a conventional invitation, avoid the inner envelope. Make sure that there's no foil lining. That won't recycle.
Reed Jones recommends serving a vegetarian buffet at the reception. Although this was the most expensive part of her reception, she believes the vegetarian food is the best way to support sustainable agriculture, especially if locally grown organic produce is included. Reed Jones also says leftover food items should be donated to a homeless shelter. Even your wedding cake can be made greener by using free-range chicken eggs, replacing all the dairy with soy substitutes, and using an alternative sweetener like honey or apple juice. While many brides would not relish the idea of having soy cream cheese frosting on their wedding cakes, this author says there are other items that can be included to make your special day the toast of the environmental community, namely the wedding dress.
There are different materials you can use that are environmentally friendly. Hemp is environmentally friendly because the plant is apparently so nasty that bugs don't live on it, and so it doesn't need to be sprayed with pesticides. And it's organically grown. When they're finished with getting the fiber part, then the rest of the plant can be turned back into the soil to break down and enrich the soil.
In addition, Reed Jones offers how-to tips for greening up your honeymoon. She says vacationing locally reduces fossil fuel emissions. Even if you do go abroad, she recommends choosing an eco-tour, which funnels money back into the local economy and respects local resources. It's a far cry from the ultimate green wedding, a trip to the Justice of the Peace, and may not be your cup of herbal tea, but for those in the environmental community, Carol Reed Jones's book may very well be the Bible for green weddings. I'm Stephen Westcott for The Environment Show.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You can't marry Ranger Rick or Smokey the Bear without a copy of this week's show. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 411. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. Producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Westcott. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for The Environment Show.